Someone asked me to speak about the insight part of insight meditation. And so I'll do something like that. But I'll start by reading a, I guess it's a song, but I'll read it like a poem, because if I sang, it wouldn't, I want to spare you the pain. And also, I don't know the tune. The tune is, it's supposed to be sung to the tune of, what says, it says here, I fought the Dharma and the Dharma won. And isn't, I guess someone told me there's a song called I Fought the Law and the Law Won. Sometimes in Buddhism, Dharma is translated as law. So who knows, what's the tune? You want to sing it? And it's by Allen Ginsberg, and it's called Do the Meditation Rock. If you want to learn how to meditate, I'll tell you now, cause it's never too late. I'll tell you how, cause I can't wait. It's just that great that it's never too late. If you are an old fraud like me, or a lama who lives in eternity, the first thing you do when you meditate is keep your spine, your backbone straight. Sit yourself down on a pillow on a chair, or sit on a pillow on the ground, or sit in a chair if the ground isn't there. Do the meditation, do the meditation. Learn a little patience and generosity. Follow your breath out, open your eyes, and sit there steady, and sit there wise. Follow your breath right, out of your nose, follow it out as far as it goes. Follow your breath, but don't hang on to the thought of your death in old Saigon. Follow your breath when thought forms rise, wherever you think, whatever you think, it's a big surprise. Do the meditation, do the meditation. Learn a little patience and generosity. All you got to do is to imitate your sitting meditating, and you're never too late. When thoughts catch up, but your breath goes on, forget what you thought about Uncle Don. Laurel Hardy, Uncle Don. Charlie Chaplin, Uncle Don. You don't have to drop your nuclear bomb. If you see a vision, come say, hello, goodbye. Play it dumb with an empty eye. If you want a Holocaust, you can recall your mind. It just went past with the western wind. Do the meditation, do the meditation. Learn a little patience and generosity. If you see apocalypse in a long red car or a flying saucer, sit where you are. If you feel a little bliss, don't worry about that. Give your wife a kiss when your tire goes flat. If you can't think straight and you don't know who to call, it's never too late to do nothing at all. Do the meditation, follow your breath, so your body and mind get together for a rest. Do the meditation, do the meditation, learn a little patience and generosity. If you sit for an hour or a minute every day, you can tell the superpower to sit the same way. You can tell the superpower to watch and wait, and to stop and meditate, because it's never too late. So then I think I'm kind of cross between probably the song and Dr. Seuss. Classic way of discussing a spiritual practice in Buddhism doesn't signal out meditation practice for itself. There's no word actually in Buddhist languages for meditation as a generic word the way we use it. And the word that's usually used for spiritual practice is called bhavana, which means cultivation, to practice or cultivate. And usually we cultivate our heart or our mind. And there's usually that cultivation and that practice is divided into three forms, three kinds. And these are called in Pali sila, samadhi, and panna. And that translates into English. Sila is like ethics or virtue, and samadhi is could be translated as concentration or stabilization of the mind. And panna can be translated either as usually as wisdom, but I've seen it sometimes translated as discernment. Sometimes wisdom is described as discriminating wisdom, but discernment I think is an interesting way of translating it, being discerning about your experience. And these three different parts to practice make up the full package of Buddhist kind of the Buddhist spirituality. Everything else is kind of subsumed within that, under that. And virtue or ethics, sila, is considered to be very important because it provides the contentment and the joy and the freedom from remorse that are essential for one to be able to meditate in order to develop some concentration and stabilization of the mind. And that's a little bit maybe unusual for us in the West to hear that a life of virtue, a life of ethics, brings joy or contentment or certainly freedom from remorse is something we can understand. But freedom from remorse is to be able to come and sit down in meditation and not worry about what you said to your coworker today. Did I say the right thing? Did I upset them? Do I have to go back tomorrow and kind of straighten it out? And you spend your meditation preoccupied and concerned about what happened during the day and your responsibility and what you have to do about it. So if you follow an ethical life, you watch your speech and you have correct speech, and so your speech doesn't leave you with things undone. But what's more unusual is an emphasis on joy that comes from living a virtuous life. And I think that often in the West, or sometimes in the West, people who are extremely virtuous are sometimes looked down upon as being a little bit weak. If you're completely 100% honest, it's kind of like almost considered to be a fault here on here at times. But the notion that actually an ethical life brings you joy is something which is very prevalent in Buddhist cultures in Asia, especially in Southeast Asia. And the people take delight in the fact that they never told a lie, or delight in the fact that they've never stolen or harmed anything or anything significant or whatever. And that joy and that contentment and that freedom from remorse then becomes a very important foundation upon which easier then to do meditation. So then meditation itself usually then starts with concentration. It doesn't have to start with concentration. All three of these can happen in different orders. Not like there's a right order for anybody to follow, but this is a traditional sequence that I'm describing. So first there's virtue or ethics, practice of virtue, and the second is the practice of concentration or stabilization of the mind. And here, concentration provides a further foundation of contentment for one's further practice. But not only contentment, but also a sense of equanimity, a stability of mind, a calmness of mind, so that the mind later can be used to look carefully at what's actually going on. If the mind is really scattered or confused or agitated, it's really hard to pay careful attention at the task at hand, what you're paying attention to. But also, not only contentment, but also here, with concentration comes a certain amount of pleasure and joy of mind, or simply joy, which makes it a lot easier then to do further meditation practice. A certain level of contentment and pleasure and joy. And of course, not all of us have pleasure and joy when we meditate, but to enter into the world of stable, concentrated meditation is to enter into a world of some kind of feeling of contentment or ease or a pleasurable feeling. And that's considered to be a fine thing to do. You don't have to turn away from that kind of pleasure. And it amazes me how often I meet people for whom the pleasure that they experience, the joy or the bliss that is possible in meditation, is considered to be unacceptable by people. For some reason, their religious upbringing has told them that it's not okay to feel joy or happiness or pleasure in the body or the mind And so when that begins happening in meditation, they recoil. And there's many, you know, many reasons for that. Part of it is we're not trained so well, many of us are not trained so well, to recognize the level of pleasure or joy that is there present with our meditation, with following our breath. Because maybe we think it's maybe wrong to feel it, or it's kind of not really the point of meditation or whatever, and so we don't simply notice it. And what happens to many of us is we're very selective in what we pay attention to. And many of us, for example, are so well trained to study and pay attention to our bad qualities, our so-called bad qualities, and to feel our unworthiness, or feel how terrible we are, how confused we are, inadequate we are. And so that we're kind of trained to kind of hone in on that part of ourselves so much that for some people it seems like their whole being is that. And it's never their whole being, it's only part of it. But there's a way in which we have this honing device that's what we zero in on. It's possible, part of meditation is to get a broader, balanced perspective of who we are. And part of that also, there's pleasure in this body and in this mind, and there's joy. And just sometimes just really to start noticing it, even though it's really, really subtle, is to start bringing some kind of balanced picture, true picture of who we are. Now the joy or the pleasure that said that comes with concentration is a joy and pleasure which is not dependent on sense objects. Most of the joys and pleasures that many of us know come with, from sense objects. You know, you get nice ice cream, or you get nice sex, or you get nice, see a nice sunset, or you see a nice, have nice food. All those are considered to be sense objects. And so there's something outside of us, in a sense, which gives us pleasure or happiness. And there's nothing wrong with that, unless the be-all and end-all for our search for happiness is in looking for it something outside of ourselves. And what's curious in Buddhist psychology is that thoughts, and you know, wonderful creative thoughts and nice, you know, fantasies, whatever thoughts, are considered to be another sense object. So even though they're kind of inside of us, they're still sense objects. And what comes with meditation is a kind of joy and a pleasure, can't come at times, which has nothing to do with sense objects. It's kind of like a completely kind of non-sense object-based kind of experience, pleasure. And I was thinking about this and wondering today about, you know, what is happiness? Many people pursue happiness. The Buddha said that all people want happiness. That's a kind of basic common denominator of all of us. We want happiness. And again, many of us search for it outside, never knowing the precious potential of happiness that exists within us, that is not based on any kind of objects. And I was wondering about the kind of things that makes people happy sometimes. And, you know, a person can be desperate to win the California lottery and could spend years being miserable and upset and angry. They wasted all this money and all this stuff. And then, bingo, they finally win the big jackpot, $32 million. They're really happy, at least for a while. What kind of happiness is that kind of happiness that's dependent on that kind of wish, kind of desperation for a certain kind of goal like that? Is that worth it? I think for myself, I wouldn't think that happiness is particularly worth it, especially after years of desperate thinking. And that's kind of an extreme example. But I wonder how much of our pursuit of happiness is in part the degree of happiness we feel is dependent on the amount of desperation or craving or clinging or deprivation that we feel we have. So that kind of happiness is kind of a balanced happiness. It's a happiness that comes as a condition to balance some condition which needs to be, that doesn't feel so good or feels unfulfilled. I mean, one way to feel happy, if you're interested in happiness, is don't eat for a week and then have a nice meal. But that's not, you know, what kind of happiness is that? The Buddha said, if by giving up a limited happiness one would see abundant happiness, let the self-reliant wise person beholding abundant happiness give up the limited pleasure. And the pleasure or the joy that the Buddha used in his own meditation, which finally led him to his enlightenment, was the joy and the pleasure that can come from meditation that's not based on any sense objects, not based on reaching out for something or getting something to kind of tickle your pleasure. And it's interesting that when people teach just concentration meditation, one of the ways to develop concentration in Buddhism is to become very is to use the pleasure or joy in the body or the mind that comes with meditation, no matter how subtle it is, to use that as a signpost for how to continue your practice. Kind of use it as an encouragement, or use it as a signpost, or use it as a way in. So you recognize however subtle or pleasant your meditation is, and you use that kind of like biofeedback. You kind of like, it's like a biofeedback signal. Instead of being a, you know, terrible buzzer or whatever, a light, you notice when there's a little bit of joy or pleasure, you say, ah, this is the right track. I'll stay on that track. And then if you lose that pleasure, it's a signal that you're lost in your thoughts, you become distracted. So developing concentration or stabilization. And the third is this, so there's virtue, there's concentration, quieting the mind, and then there's discernment, wisdom, which is penetratingly seeing clearly what is actually happening now. And again, you cannot see clearly if your mind is really scattered and busy and confused. It's hard, at least, to do that. Now, part of the function of discernment is to discern or to see through the veils of concepts that we live in and which we get caught up in. And it's the discernment part of our practice which cuts through the clinging or the attachment that we tend sometimes to be lost in and wound up in and suffer as a result from. And it's this discernment, clearly seeing what's happening in our experience, which helps us to live life directly rather than through ideas or thoughts about life. And there's a huge difference between those two, living life directly and living life through our ideas and our thoughts. So calm and stability is used as a foundation for discernment, both in meditation and in daily life. And I know I said this last week, but I think it's worth saying it again, that one of the ways to use the little bit of calm or steadiness you've gotten in meditation is to use that meditation to look around, understand yourself, your mind, the workings of your mind better. In particular, to notice when your mind clamps down on something, when your mind reaches out and gets and stops at something and freezes at something and clings to something, or when it loses itself in some preoccupation. And that certainly can be done when you're in your meditation itself, and that's a great place to notice it. Sometimes easier than anywhere else. But one of the very nice exercises to do is, after your morning meditation, is to notice how long it takes after your meditation for your mind to freeze up the first time, or cling or get lost in itself or get preoccupied in something and lose its consciousness or lose its mindfulness of general mindfulness of what's going on. And so this morning, you know, I was doing it this morning. And I was, after my meditation, I was doing my exercises. And halfway through the exercises, my mind clamped down on, I got a lot to do today. Maybe I should rush through this. Maybe I'll drop part of my exercise program or whatever. And that's where it was. I saw it pretty much immediately, but that's where it was. And it could be interesting to notice if there's any patterns, because it might be that it's every morning at breakfast. You meditate and you have breakfast, and at breakfast you get caught up. You start eating fast and you're reading the paper and suddenly you're anxious. If you notice it as a pattern, then you can choose, is this how you want to live your life? And then, okay, so you take care of that. So then you figure out a nice way to have breakfast. And then you notice that you get caught up and anxious or lost as you're driving to work. And that's a pattern. you want to do that. Maybe you want to do that. Maybe it's fine. But at least decide to. Or maybe decide, well, maybe I don't have to do that. Maybe I'll try to extend that sense of presence, of mindfulness, not only in breakfast, but into driving to work. So great. So you've done that. But you keep doing the exercise. And then it's when you, the first time you walk into the, you know, through the door to work. Someone said today that so many of us put on a work face or personality when we go to work. We can't really be ourselves fully at work. So what is the consequence of that? Well, the mind closes up or something happens. So I think you get the point, right? It's a great exercise. And so you can use the calm and stabilization of meditation to help you in daily life that way. So examples of how we live in ideas. So part of the function of discernment is to distinguish between living in ideas and not living so caught in ideas and concepts. If all of us left tonight and got into a different car and drove home with a different car than we came with, our cars wouldn't care one bit. The world of possessions, and this car is mine, that car is yours, and all that, doesn't belong to the world of cars, right? That's the world. The cars out there are completely peaceful. and if we get into the wrong car, the car stays just as peaceful. It, you know, couldn't care less. You're not that loyal. The world of possessiveness of me and mine belongs to the world of concepts and ideas. It's in our mind that we create such things. It belongs, what's called in Buddhism, as I talked about last week, it belongs to the conventional reality. It's a conceptual reality, and it has no ultimate truth. It has nothing to do with ultimate reality, the way things are. They have to do with the projection of our constructs onto the reality which we find ourselves. But that world of possessions and ideas around that, people are willing to kill over it. I mean, it's very solid. It's like, that's like more permanent than anything. That's like a really solid preoccupation for many people. I didn't bring it, maybe spared you, but the quote that I read many times about the sandcastles from the Buddha Sutra of the kids who make a sandcastle, and then one knocks the other kid's sandcastle down and they beat him up and get all upset, and then they go back to playing with the sandcastle and say, no one can break down my sandcastle, and stay away from my sandcastle, it's mine. And then it becomes dusk and it's time to go home for dinner, and they all knock down their sandcastles and run off. They don't care anymore. It's all, you know, possession is in the mind. I have a friend who has a Lexus, nice shiny Lexus, and he has an old Toyota Tercel. And he says that when he comes to intersections, like at the same time as someone else, when he's in his Lexus, he almost always gets the right of way. And when he drives his old Tercel, he almost never gets the right of way. And the intersection in the cars couldn't care less. You know, who gets the right of way? That belongs to the world of concepts and ideas, and that we tend to live in and swim in, and it runs our life. And there are many, you know, so the ideas of time are concepts. And many of us, you know, are caught up in time and oppressed by time. How many of you are oppressed by time? How many of you are not oppressed by time? You're embarrassed, huh? Boy, what have we come to? You have to be embarrassed that you're not oppressed by time. So ideas of time. And does reality care about daylight savings time? You know, suddenly the time changes. Has anything changed except our ideas have changed? Or time zones. Have you ever crossed a time zone? Mm-hmm. Have you looked and noticed around you what's changed? And then a little bit maybe the more difficult concept for me to explain, but does a coffee table care if it becomes a massage table or becomes a bench or becomes a sewing table or a footrest? Does it care? What is it about coffee tableness? Where is coffee tableness found?
Macy's.
At Macy's. Coffee tableness? I don't know. So if you lay down on top of your coffee table and take a nap there, put a mattress on, you have guests coming and you have a nice big long coffee table, and you put a mattress on top and put it in your bedroom, is it still a coffee table? I think that we apply concepts to a piece of reality and we say that's what it is, but it's very flexible. Some things are very flexible. And it can be something else. Suddenly it could become a bookcase, a bookshelf, you know. You put up against the wall and you put your books against it. Is it a coffee table or is it a bookcase? I think concepts are quite fluid. And the coffee table couldn't care less. The coffee table doesn't belong to the world of concepts, of coffee table or bench or anything else.
But it doesn't have a consciousness.
Sorry?
It doesn't have a consciousness.
Yes, so?
We do.
So?
Do.
So, it's different.
Do we? Do we? So there's other concepts. Concepts of self, for example. So we're getting close to this thing that has a consciousness, right? So what are some of the concepts of self that we have? That are just ideas that don't have anything really to do with anything serious in reality, perhaps. I mean, one of the classic examples is personal beauty, our beauty, right? I mean, you know that beauty goes through fads. And what was beautiful in the 1800s or 1700s, you know, these nice plump women, they were kind of, what's the right word for voluptuous? And what? Ruben, yes. I mean, those poor women today would be completely neurotic. Maybe not, but I should be careful what I say here. But but just kind of generically they would be. You know, but back then they were like the, you know, they wouldn't win any beauty contests today, but they were did back then. Or the beauties of the 1950s are different from the 60s and different from the 70s and different from the 80s. And now in the 90s, apparently the kind of the beautiful woman has more the athletic look. You know, that's kind of the standard today. It's a lot different than what it was earlier. So we go through styles, and then we get oppressed because of it. I mean, I'm not just right for the decade. You know, I was good for the 80s, but not for the 90s. You know, so you have this self-concept, this idea, and you bought into the concepts of society. They're just concepts and ideas. Our body, you know, couldn't care less, you know, if we fit in some model of beauty or not. Except that it cares because if we get tight and stressed about it or tense about it, that tension gets translated into the body. So the world of concept is often where we live. And one of the things we do in meditation is to start seeing that there's a difference between how things actually are experienced directly and what our thoughts and ideas about it are. And it's great to be able to see the difference because then you can be very playful with concepts. And part of Zen training is to learn how to be playful with concepts, to learn that concepts are not God-given. And that's the way things are. And like, is it Plato, kind of Platonic concepts that are, you know, forever, that's the way it is? The perfect table. All models are modeled after the perfect table. Part of Zen training is to learn to be flexible with concepts and to be able to transform things in your mind from one thing to another, knowing that how flexible concepts are. And, you know, there's some limits, of course, but there's a lot of flexibility. So the part of the discernment, then, is noticing the difference between our ideas and what's actually there. And that frees us quite a bit because we realize that we have a lot of choice in our ideas, and we don't necessarily have to buy into them when we see there's an alternative. Buddhism then distinguishes between four kinds of experience you can have that are considered to be direct experiences, kind of unmediated by concepts, more or less. Sometimes described as ultimate, the four ultimates. These are things which can be experienced rather than thought about. The first is the four properties of sensations, the world of sensations. And these four properties of sensations are usually classified according to the, what's usually in English it's called the earth, water, fire, and air elements. But I think it might be more accurate to translate it literally as earth, liquid, heat, and wind. And these are some symbols that represent the earth. Represents those experiences that have to do, sensations that have to do with hardness and softness and extension. Liquid experiences are those that have to do with fluidity and cohesion. Things that, when you, the feeling of things being held together, it's said in Buddhist psychology, belongs to the water or liquid element. Maybe because you take flour and put water in it, it sticks together. The heat element has to do with temperature, hot and cold. And the wind element has to do with movement and vibration. And there's all kinds of varieties of that and combinations of these things, but these are primary sensations that we experience. And then there's secondary properties that come from these, and I don't understand how they come from them, but color, odor, taste, and nutritional quality is supposed to come, somehow arise out of those first four. So Buddhists will say things like, this floor doesn't exist. Hardness is what really exists. What the floor is we have a concept, an idea of a floor, but in the world of our direct experience, what we experience is hardness. So if we close our eyes, it's easier to sense. If you close your eyes, what can you actually experience right now? What you experience is hardness and weight and pressure against this. That's, I mean, not even against, you just, that's all you feel. Our memory and our memory and the various concepts we stored in there about where we are and what's going on translates those sensations into, oh, this must be a floor. You know, but have you ever, has it ever happened to you that, you know, like it's dark?
You could be sitting on the roof.
Has it ever happened to you that it was dark and you put your hand somewhere, or your foot somewhere, and it took a while to realize where it was?
I mean,
what?
It's the wall.
Well, that's kind of obvious, maybe, but...
Not necessarily.
But maybe not.
Depends on what you've been dreaming.
the example I can think of now is when I went to live on this farm once. And the first time I went to use the outhouse, it was dark. And I sat down, and it was all soft. So, of course, you know, my mind... So just softness. But, you know, my mind knew I was in an outhouse, in a toilet. There's probably, you know, outhouses, you know, it was an outhouse, it was a compost toilet, you know, just, and so all that pieced together, softness, you know, I pieced it together. So it took me a while to realize was they had very soft styrofoam foam as a toilet seat. So the mind is very quick, you know, to put the concepts. And in the world of direct experience, there was just softness. So there's a difference, right? And again, Buddhists will say the body is a concept. You don't have a body. In the world of direct experience, there is no body. Body is this general, gross concept. What you have is particular sensations. And those sensations then are concepts put together and call it a body. And many times, and I don't know if many, but often in meditation, people have the experience of the body disappearing. And partly because the conceptual level of thinking, of relating to the world, sometimes is put to rest. And if the conceptual level way of thinking is put to rest and, you know, finally gets a vacation, you're not constructing a body, an idea of a body, from all these sensations you're experiencing. You're just experiencing sensation. And often it's our ideas about sensations which hold the sensations together. Our ideas about our sensations, the concepts we form around them, is what gives us the false impression those sensations are permanent, that they're there in a kind of steady, constant way. And, I mean, the best place in meditation to see that is when you feel some pain somewhere in the body. And I think we've probably gone through this before, somewhere or other, but If you freak out because you feel pain in your leg as you're sitting here, all these thoughts about, oh my God, and this is going to last forever, and I'm going to break my leg, and I'm going to be invalid, and why don't they ring the bell, and this is, and it just goes on and on, and pretty soon we're lost in the world of our commentary and our ideas and our fears and our thoughts about it, and we're not really paying attention to what's going on in the leg. And if we bring our attention very carefully into the leg, you'll see that the pain is not a constant, solid thing, as much as your mind wants it to be or is afraid it might be. It's actually, the closer you can see it, you'll see that it's maybe throbbing or in flux. So there's moments with it, pain, moments without. Or it's moving. One of the great jokes is you feel tremendous pain and you go looking at it really carefully. Where is it? And the closer you get, you can't get to it, because as soon as you get to the place where it was, it's moved another place. It kind of moves around. And it's kind of like, well, gee, thanks. And again, this thing I said earlier about how we tend to select out certain things to pay attention to because of our predispositions. And we tend to select out certain sensations. Some people select out the pleasant sensations. They select out the beauty of who they are and stress that and forget, completely ignoring the shadow side of their life, their suffering or the pain. And the other people who do the opposite, who focus on the suffering part of their life, the shadow side, or whatever, it's not shadow if you're focusing on it, but, and then some people ignore their beauty. Same with sensations. Part of being a teacher, one of the things I do as a teacher is I try to listen very carefully to what's being left out in people's awareness. And so when one person I might say, I might point my finger at their beauty that's there, that what's really beautiful and wonderful and precious that's in that person. And someone else, I might I'll ignore that and say, hey, have you noticed over here all this yucky stuff? Concepts are what are permanent. Reality is always changing. And so the illusion of permanence, which is often a place of a lot of suffering, is really belongs to the world of concepts and ideas. And the direct, you see, these are the ultimates, the sensations are in constant flux. And spiritual practice, Buddhist spiritual practice, a spiritual practice that is not slave to ideas is one that is constantly aware that life is a process, that rests in the flow of sensations and phenomena in the body as they occur. I don't know why it has to be this way, but a lot of the healing, a lot of the power of mindfulness practice comes when we drop out of our thoughts and ideas about what's happening and rest in the sensations associated with that. So if there's a lot of, in our emotional life, it's a place that often needs a lot of healing or a lot of processing or whatever. And if we're trying to process it in the storyline level of what's going on, it's very difficult because we kind of often get lost in the stories and ideas about it all. Not to knock that, it has its place. But if we can drop below the storyline and into the sensations associated with those emotions and free ourselves of the concepts associated with the sensations, those sensations then are given a free rein to process themselves and they unfold and move. And so often, I see it over and over and over again. Someone was telling me this weekend about his tremendous fear about dying. And what he has learned is that he hasn't actually, he's not free of his fear, but he's found that if he goes into the fear and feels the sensations of fear in his body, the sensations will transform themselves into some sense of ease and calm. And because of that, he's not afraid of his fear anymore. And it's okay for him to have his fear. So physical sensations is one of the ultimates, the things we can directly experience. Another one is consciousness, the stream of knowing. And consciousness in Buddhism is kind of synonymous with knowing itself, because, anyway, they're more or less the same thing. And when the mindfulness is clear enough and you can powers of observations are strong enough, you'll notice that your consciousness, your ability to know, arises and passes like everything else. And if you don't see that, it's very easy then to think that consciousness is permanent and absolute and end up making some kind of metaphysical truths about the, you know, about the consciousness being yourself or consciousness being eternal or this or that. But if you're very observant, you'll see the rising and passing of consciousness, the rising and passing of knowing. And normal consciousness arises and passes with what is known. There is no consciousness without, almost normal, there's no normal consciousness without there being something that's known at the same time. So try to look for a consciousness that doesn't know anything. You know? You won't find anything if you look carefully. The third ultimate is what's called mental factors. And these are the qualities of mind that are engaged or come into play with how our consciousness relates to the objects of knowing. And there's usually as many lists, there's a list of 52 in one tradition of Buddhism of these kinds of mental factors that come into play. And some are always present in all states of mind, and some are considered to be wholesome and some unwholesome states of mind, qualities of mind.
Could you give a couple of examples of those?
And they often appear in combination. So greed, hatred, and delusion are factors of mind. And the opposites, non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion are factors of mind. And those are kind of synonymous with love and generosity and understanding or wisdom. Some of them have wonderful names like pliancy of mind and buoyancy of mind. And Stephen, do you know some of the other wholesome and unwholesome ones?
No.
But you know, greed, hate, and delusion are kind of also the umbrella term it's called the root for all the unwholesome ones. And non-greed, non-hate, non-illusion is kind of the umbrella terms for all the wholesome ones. So states of mind, the quality of a relationship that we form. Aversion, desire, love, generosity, kindness, friendliness. And it's said in Buddhism, and you don't have to believe it exactly, but maybe challenged by it, is that these also, the mental factors, these mental qualities, are considered to be impersonal and impermanent. Impersonal in the sense that there's no self there. They just arise and pass. And since they arise and pass and are sometimes there and sometimes not, are you going to say that that's yourself? Are you going to call a self something which was there yesterday but not today? Then you're in trouble. But it's here now, so that's good. Then you have a self, but it's gone tomorrow. The consciousness arises and passes, so it can't be the self, they say in Buddhism. The sensations arise and pass, they can't be self. So where's the self? So there's these three areas of practice. There's practice of ethics, practice of stabilization of mind, of quieting the mind, and that's very important. And quieting the mind a little bit, letting mind become a little bit stable, helps us really to give voice to some of the deeper intentions and deeper voices that are within us, some of the things that are repressed and lost. And many of us, I think, who live very busy lives, we need a little bit more calm, and it's part of the function of meditation. From a little bit of calm, we can do what's called vipassana. Vipassana, mindfulness practice, is not really dependent on becoming calm or any one condition, like I keep saying. But it really helps a lot to be a little bit stabilized. And then vipassana has to do with this discernment, seeing clearly what's actually happening in the moment and being able to see the difference between the commentary and our concepts and ideas of stuff and resting in the direct experience, the direct sensations, the direct relationships we form, the factors of mind. As we do this, we'll naturally become aware of impermanence, because the only thing, semblance of permanence, is in the world of concepts and ideas. And if we drop below the level of concepts and ideas, we enter into a world that's in constant flux and change. And this is where the where the beginning of the insight is of insight practice, in terms of the big eye. There can be lots of small insights, but big insight begins with seeing impermanence. And there's an interesting progression as meditation deepens of how we see impermanence usually. First, normally we're often just aware of something while we're in the middle of it. Something happens, we notice we're in the middle of it. We're thinking, we notice we're thinking when we're in the middle of the thought. We're angry, notice we're angry in the middle of being angry. Kind of notice something in the middle of the experience. As our power of observation becomes stronger, we can become aware of the beginning of an experience. You see the thought form just beginning to form itself. Or you see the anger beginning to arise. Or you see a sensation in the body beginning to arise. You just kind of see it wasn't there, and you see it appears on the scene. As observation becomes keener, you see more clearly. You'll notice not only the beginning, but you notice that there's a beginning and a middle and an end of that experience. You see its whole life, with clear enough awareness, you see the whole life cycle, the whole lifetime of a particular experience. It rises, it's there, and it passes away. As this ability to see the impermanence more and more clearly comes and develops, the other two major insights of insight practice appear. And they appear a little bit differently in different people, the sequence of how they appear. But often, one of the next ones is you realize that none of that is a self. There's no self there. That if something's constantly in flux, where are you going to find yourself? Because every time you try to hang on something as a self, it vanishes. Because you see how it's always vanishing. Everything's passing away. And eventually, even the knower, it's sometimes difficult, the knowing of impermanence, the knower, it sometimes has a semblance of permanence. It seems like everything else is happening impermanently around this thing called the knower. But with enough careful awareness, you'll see even the knower is arising and passing. The observer arises and passes. And you'll find no sense of I, because I, the idea, any idea we have of I, of myself, is an idea. It belongs to the world of concepts. Part of this then also, or unreliability, because things are constantly arising and passing away, you can't rely on them as a place for security, or a place for some kind of permanent happiness, or a crutch or a support. And it can get very frightening in spiritual life when you realize there's nothing that can prop you up. And you need to be really well propped up beforehand in your spiritual practice to have the strength, the character to see nothing will prop you up. And that's why, having a good moral foundation, a good concentration, a good spiritual friends, and a teacher to talk to and all that is very important so that you don't lose heart when you realize that nothing holds you up. And so you realize what's called the unsatisfactoriness of our experience. You can't rely on it. And every time you try, what's really fascinating is things are constantly in flux, moving around, and you see our tendencies to grasp and hold on to and rest somewhere, and you see that you try to reach out for it and it's gone and it moves, and you try to go there and it's already moved. And just can't, it's hopeless. And after a while, you kind of say, well, this is ridiculous. And it doesn't make any sense to grasp or hold on to, because it's just not there to hold on to, because things are so impermanent. This world of direct experience is constantly in flux. And so you relax. And pretty soon you relax enough to learn to trust that world, and a level of deep, probably the deepest forms of, one of the deepest forms of trust that a human being can have arises when you learn to trust and rest in, it's called sometimes, someone had the expression, wisdom of insecurity, or not needing to know, not needing to hold on to anything. But you develop a certain equanimity of mind, equanimity to all things, because you're neither pushing anything away or holding on to anything. And as, when that becomes really strong and mature, the tendency not to hold on to anything, not to cling to anything, not to depend on anything at all, consciousness this thing called conscious awareness becomes free. And when the consciousness becomes free, there becomes the experience of nibbana, or enlightenment, that sometimes is talked about in Buddhism. And this is a very unusual experience. And it's an experience, it's a possibility of awareness that holds to nothing, even to itself, particularly to itself. And since we can only talk about what is known, awareness without knowing, without a knowingness, awareness without something to be known, awareness without consciousness is very difficult to describe. So I'm stuck. And so the insight of insight practice with a big eye is to see very clearly by connecting with reality directly, not through our concepts and ideas, impermanence, non-selfhood, and the unsatisfactoriness of all objects of knowing, anything you can know. And then nirvana is the fourth and last of the ultimate experiences that you can know directly. So there's sensations, there's consciousness, there's the mental qualities, and nibbana, and that's it, folks. Those four. And so, if I may, I'll read two things. And the first one I was supposed to read somewhere earlier in the talk, but I didn't. So you have to figure out where it belongs. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as a seed goes to the next as a blossom, goes on as a fruit. And that's a lot of what meditation does for us. And then I'll close with this. In the point of rest at the center of our being, we encounter a world where all things are at rest in the same way. Then a tree becomes a mystery, a cloud a revelation, each person a cosmos of whose riches we can only catch glimpses. The life of simplicity is simple, but it opens to us a book in which we never get beyond the first syllable. That's by Dag Hammarskjöld. The name here is Markova. And if you go home in the wrong car tonight, please bring it back next week.
The form of that famous bird, truly the form is quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a little bit hard to read at times.
Oh, I see. All right. That's going to be very interesting. Well, I heard him read it last year.
Oh.
It was just
Did he sing it or read it?